Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Dr. Sylvia Earle, has been called the greatest advocate our oceans have ever had. Dr. Earle has spent the past 70 years exploring our vast ocean, and that is a lot of time underwater, about 7,000 hours. She also holds several records, including in 1979 for the deepest untethered dive by a woman. The documentary Mission Blue, which is really incredible, tells the story of Dr. Sylvia Earle as she travels the globe on an urgent mission to shed light on the dire condition of Earth's oceans. Here is the trailer for Mission Blue.
I see things that others do not.
A different world. A world that's changed enormously just in my lifetime.
My backyard was the Gulf of Mexico. That's where I first fell in love with the ocean. I think if others had the opportunity to witness what I have seen in my lifetime from thousands of hours underwater, I would not seem like a radical at all.
It's a pleasure to introduce a scientist, an engineer, a teacher, and an explorer.
The ocean is dying. All of us, we are the beneficiaries of having burned through fossil fuels. But at what cost? 60 years ago, when I began exploring the ocean, no one imagined that we could do anything to harm it. I saw the after influence of what we can do to the natural world.
Think of the world without an ocean. You've got a planet a lot like Mars.
No ocean, no life. No ocean, no us.
In 1990, she became the chief scientist for NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
I went to one meeting, and I was never allowed to go again.
I feel that I must resign, and as a private citizen, do what I can do with more freedom.
She's not afraid to say, you know what you're doing and it's wrong.
I really speak for the ocean. If we continue business as usual, we're in real trouble.
She's made it her life's purpose to make sure everybody else understands what's going on.
Sylvia has a wish for the planet, what she calls her Mission Blue. Protect the ocean in the same way we now protect the land.
I wish for a global network of marine protected areas to save and restore the ocean.
That is the trailer for Mission Blue, an incredible documentary that tells the story of Dr. Sylvia Earle's important work, and you can watch it on Netflix. It really is a must-see. Dr. Earle says you cannot address climate change without taking care of the ocean. And at the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow, which just ended, she called for an industrial fishing ban on the high seas. Dr. Sylvia Earle is a world-renowned oceanographer and National Geographic explorer at large. In 1990, she became the first female chief scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And she's out with a massive new book. It's actually almost 500 pages, National Geographic Ocean, A Global Odyssey. It just came out today. She'll be speaking at the Aquarium of the Bay in San Francisco this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. And we are actually trying to get Dr. Earle on the line. Unfortunately, she is not answering her phone. So what we're going to do, and hopefully we'll get in touch with her, is we'll open the lines and we'd love to hear from any of you who have stories about spending time underwater, any stories about the ocean. Dr. Earle really emphasizes that, you know, basically she says the ocean is the blue heart of our planet. And if there's no blue, there's no green. Whatever we do on land is wholly dependent on how well we protect the seas. But the ocean doesn't get as much attention at a conference like COP, for example. So if you have any stories to share about the ocean or any of your experiences spending time underwater, we would love to hear from you. In the meantime, I just want to read from a Guardian piece about Sylvia Earle's call to ban industrial fishing. Again, she says, world leaders gathered for COP must ban industrial fishing on the high seas in order to have a chance of preserving the ocean. Sylvia Earle, who is now 86, has clocked up more than 7,000 hours underwater. She took part in events with Al Gore, John Kerry, and many other people who are in very high positions of power, saying that stopping industrial fishing in international waters is as important as curbing fossil fuel emissions. Sylvia Earle calling for a ban on industrial fishing. And I believe we now have Dr. Earle. Hi, Dr. Earle. Are you with us?
I'm with you. I had a nice cup of coffee.
Okay, great. So now you're wide awake. Thank you so much for joining us. So I want to ask you, Dr. Earle, I want to ask you about your experience at COP26. You used your platform on a panel to call on world leaders to ban industrial fishing. And as I just said, you argue that it's just as important as curbing fossil fuel use. So tell us more about this. Why did you call on world leaders to ban industrial fishing?
One of the big headlines at COP26 was recognition of what people are calling blue carbon, life in the ocean. We understand, or coming to understand, that trees and other plants on the land are critical components of carbon capture, oxygen generation, for a long time, a part of the climate discussion. But life in the ocean, follow the carbon. Economists follow the money. Scientists are following the carbon. Carbon capture, carbon sequestration. The ocean is the biggest carbon sink on Earth. And to acknowledge that what we're taking out of the ocean is contributing to the generation of carbon dioxide and the loss of carbon capture, the millions of tons of ocean wildlife that are extracted every year, and the destruction of the systems in the deep sea and even in coastal waters through trawling and other activities are releasing carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. So the high seas occupy about half of the world. That is literally space that is beyond national jurisdiction, the global commons. Only about five countries are taking the bulk of what is removed from the high seas. And these are subsidized activities that really are not necessary for food security or economic reasons. If you take away the subsidies, these fishing operations in the high seas simply would not be profitable. So when you think of the amount of carbon that is extracted through high seas fishing and the destruction of the systems that naturally capture carbon and generate oxygen, if we fail to safeguard these basic processes in our life support system, it doesn't matter what else we do, we still won't really be addressing the climate change issues adequately.
Well, and then to drill down and to talk about how this actually affects underwater life, also, you were recently in conversation with penguin expert Dee Boersma, who said that penguins, like everyone else, all other underwater life, they need something to eat. And she said there used to be millions of African penguins, for example. Now there might be 10,000 breeding pairs, and it's because the fisheries have taken out the small fish.
You know, there's more than one way to kill birds, more than one way to kill whales, and that is by taking what they eat. Mm-hmm. The other dark side of that is the fishing gear that is lost or tossed into the ocean. It has become another major problem for life in the sea, and therefore back to us, and that is the capture entanglement of so many creatures, hundreds of thousands of marine mammals, birds, turtles, and of course fish and squid are lost, killed by this derelict fishing gear that has unfortunately been a new phenomenon in the ocean, mostly since the 1950s. But it has scaled up in terms of its abundance, and it's that these synthetic materials are one of their great attributes is they're durable, but that's one of their downsides as well, that these durable nets and lines and traps that are made of synthetic materials that were deployed back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, they're still out there, still killing things. It just is a growing phenomenon. In addition to what is taken out of the ocean on an everyday basis, what is being killed by lost and tossed gear continues to haunt us.
Dr. Earle, for people who are not familiar with industrial fishing, can you tell us more about it and how it's really changed over the decades?
When I was a child, the role of fishermen was highly respected in communities because they supplied food for families and communities. Now, industrial fishing goes far beyond that, finding a place for ourselves within the natural systems, taking some but not taking so much that you destroy the very systems that you rely on for sustenance or for livelihoods. The high seas is not really accessed by any indigenous human population. It's only accessible by going, using modern methods of going well beyond normal range of local fishermen. The exclusive economic zone of nations extend out 200 nautical miles. Beyond that, it's the Wild West, it's the high seas, the global commons, where little governance really shapes the activities there. And the ships that are deployed, again, using subsidies from taxpayers to give low interest or no interest loans to build very large ships and to supply their fuel at a discount, they can travel and do travel, and using technologies that did not exist even 50, let alone 100 or 1,000 years ago, to find your place at sea, echolocation, sonar to determine where the fish are, then to deploy these enormous nets that encircle entire populations of organisms, squid and small fish and large fish, long lines. When the term long line is used, it's just, they really are long lines. I mean, think about miles of baited hooks every few feet, hooks that use squid and small fish for bait to catch larger fish. You could probably feed a small country on what is being used for bait alone on these huge, extensive long lines that are really stripping sharks, tunas, swordfish, and many birds that go to the bait, marine mammals that are attracted to the bait as well. That the bycatch issue is a hidden cost of what consumers get when they go to the market, whether it's bycatch in nets or bycatch from hooks and lines that are deployed on this mega scale in the ocean. For every fish that appears on your plate, you think of the lives that are also lost as part of the cost of the bycatch, creatures that are caught but are not considered useful and are simply tossed back into the ocean. Once again, that carbon would stay locked in as a part of a living network of life, contributes to both the destruction of those processes, but when fish are taken out of the ocean, and squid and shrimp and all other forms of life that we should think of as carbon-based units, that carbon goes into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide or methane. And that's why blue carbon is now rather hot topic in climate change discussions.
Dr. Earle, The Guardian wrote about your call for a ban on industrial fishing, and they included a report by the Stimson Center that found China and Taiwan account for 60% of industrial fishing. According to The Guardian, China's vast fishing fleet, by far the world's largest, has been overfishing seas much further from the world's gaze than the islands known for their giant tortoises and iguanas. From West Africa's Gulf of Guinea to the Korean Peninsula, the fleet has moved into the waters of other countries. They turn off transponders to avoid detection. They're depleting fish stocks for poor coastal communities, and we can talk about that in a minute. And then the other countries are Japan, South Korea, and Spain. They make up about 10% each. What response did you hear, Dr. Earle, when you called for a ban on industrial fishing at COP26?
I'm not alone in calling for that. It's many voices have been acknowledging this is a serious problem that really faces all of us, but not too many people are aware of what's going on. You know, we talk a lot about the illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, but it's the legal fishing. Many of these operations are perfectly legal and supported by subsidies. We need to change, armed with knowledge, we need to come together to say this is legally wrong, not and should not be supported.
What can people do? We've done a lot of shows about, quote, sustainable fish, and you haven't eaten fish for many decades, right? What can people do who do eat fish who don't want to take part in this system?
I think the first thing is to become tuned in, knowledgeable, and to recognize life in the ocean. This is wildlife. The biggest wildlife trade on Earth is what we call seafood, sea life, squid, octopus, shrimp. Of course, the many variations on the theme of fish that we generally lump together just as fish. We dine on fish sticks. You should ask, what is in a fish stick? Where did it come from? How old are these creatures? Many of the animals we take from the sea are decades old. Mm. Some are older than your grandparents. It's just wrong to take bites out of the ocean on creatures that are simply not sustainable on an industrial scale. And we're paying the price with our with the destruction of the very systems that keep us alive. Our life support system is underpinned by the wild animals and plants and other forms of life in the sea and on the land. And we don't seem to have the same respect or caring for wild animals in the ocean that we have begun to accord for songbirds and eagles, owls, and other wild lions, tigers, you name it, all the creatures that are receiving enhanced care. They're not in great shape. We need to do better for wildlife on the land. But in the ocean, we subsidize their killing. It's just bizarre that we allow wild animals in the ocean to be taken on the scale that they are, especially when we recognize how important they are to the integrity of the very systems, the carbon-based systems, the cycles of life that keep us alive.
Dr. Earle, a number of activists have criticized COP26 for not talking about big ag, about the effect that meat and dairy has on the climate, and you can add fish to that. And I just wonder how you think we should be talking about this issue moving forward, because according to a New Scientist, the world's hunger for fish, and you could add meat to this, is expected to almost double by the year 2050 due to growing affluence and populations. So how can we tackle this issue?
Recognizing that when our numbers were small. Go back to 1800, there were 1 billion of us. Go back 10,000 years ago, our numbers were in the thousands, not maybe the low millions. But here we are in the 21st century, faced with a planet that doesn't change in size, but with our population demanding more of the natural systems to support our prosperity. So nature is declining while we are prospering, but we have reached that point where our numbers will be affected by the loss of nature unless we realize what we can do to work within the natural systems that sustain us. Our appetite for wild animals from the sea and for eating animals from the land has greatly increased even in my lifetime. But we now recognize that our predecessors largely ate a more plant-based diet with meat from whatever source. I include fish in that category called meat. But we need to think about what realistically, how do we have a nutritious diet, a delicious diet with far less meat and far less fish? It's not a requirement. It's truly not a need. We have this illusion that we have to eat meat, some kind of animal, to get protein. But every living thing has protein. We couldn't live without it. So when you look at all the plants that we consume, they all have protein. And we can get sufficient protein just and other, even, well, the other elements that we need for our sustenance from a totally plant-based diet, or at least to go with a largely plant-based diet and consider how much of the rest of the menu we really must have, either by choice or necessity. And the necessity part is an illusion. We do not have to eat animals to survive and thrive. So we need to challenge the great chefs of the world. How do we make all the thousands of kinds of plants out there delicious? And we have marketed the concept that we've got to eat meat and we have to catch fish. We can market and make known the reality that plants are really good for you, and they should taste good too.
We have an email from Robert who says, thank you so much for your work. Robert says, can you talk a little bit more about what people can do on an everyday basis? Choosing what seafood is okay to eat? Can you recommend a website? Are you saying don't eat seafood at all?
I'm saying that we don't have to eat seafood at all. And I don't really like the term seafood. We don't say all the creatures on the land are land food, but we look at all of life in the sea as something potentially to put on our plates. And, you know, we need to think of it as sea life, the way they should all be regarded as wildlife. They are. We didn't plant them. We don't harvest them. We kill them. We take them. We extract them. We don't have, it's wrong to think that we're you know, harvesting the ocean when it's just a term used, should be used explicitly for farming, land farming at that. But what to do? I would say, use your individual power of choice and to think about if you want to do something positive for your place in the greater scheme of things, look at what your talents are, what do you care about, and to work with others who share common goals. No one can do everything to solve the big problems we face, but for sure, everyone can do something. And by teaming up and working with others, you know, we can really change where we are to get to a better place.
And Dr. Earle, before we go to break, every person I've met who says, we just can't do this anymore, you know, you don't need this kind of food or this kind of meat, for example, I have not heard one person say that people living in coastal communities should also stop eating fish, for example. But this overfishing has greatly affected coastal communities' livelihoods. Can you talk about that before we go to break?
This concept of high seas fishing, the ability to get out into the half the world beyond national jurisdiction. It's new. It's happened in the last few decades, and it has scaled up quickly with the technologies that not only enable us to power our way across the ocean, usually using fossil fuels, and to refrigerate the whatever it is that is taken so that it can get to a distant market, and the ability to find where the fish are using sonar technologies that did not exist until the middle of the 20th century, to track fish, to be safe at sea because you know what the weather is. That was not possible until fairly recently in human history. So all the technologies are in favor of the fishermen, and there's not much to really yield protection that once did exist for these high seas and deep sea animals. They were protected by their inaccessibility. Now we can go anywhere from the surface to the greatest depths, and we are fishing deeper, and we're using distant markets to provide a place to take fish that once you can only take so many if you couldn't refrigerate or salt the fish or otherwise keep them for long periods of time. Now fish taken from one part of the planet are flown by jet or in containers, refrigerated, thousands of miles away from their source. And as a consequence, there's nothing sacred in the ocean anymore. We're taking everywhere, all the time, with large-scale means. If we are to have, even in coastal fisheries, for people who really do rely on the ocean for sustenance, which is a relatively small fragment of human society, it's the equivalent of bushmeat. There's some people who really need to take wild animals for sustenance, but that's a tiny fraction of what is taken from the ocean goes to support the true needs of people anywhere.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we are joined by Dr. Sylvia Earle, a world-renowned oceanographer and National Geographic's explorer at large. Dr. Earle has spent the past 70 years exploring our vast ocean. She became the first female chief scientist of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and she's out with a new book, National Geographic Ocean, A Global Odyssey. It's out today. It's full of incredible, incredible photos. And we will talk about what happens when you stop killing sea life and protect it. It does come back. And she has so many examples of this in her new book. Dr. Earle will be speaking at the Aquarium of the Bay in San Francisco this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are spending the hour with Dr. Sylvia Earle, who has spent the past 70 years exploring our vast ocean. She's been called the greatest advocate our oceans have ever had. There's so much of Sylvia's work is on our website, yourcallradio.org. Dr. Earle is president and chair of Mission Blue. This is an organization that inspires action to explore and protect the ocean. And her new book is National Geographic Ocean, A Global Odyssey. She'll be speaking at the Aquarium of the Bay in San Francisco this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Dr. Earle, Mary Jane writes, I propose that Dr. Earle publish a cookbook, Diet for a Healthy Ocean, which would contain no seafood but invite vegetarian and vegan recipes and sustainable shopping tips from the best chefs and conservation information sources.
It's a great idea.
Well, thank you for that, Mary Jane. We've got just, again, Dr. Earle, a number of comments from people who say, for those of us who are not going vegan tomorrow, which fish might be better than others to eat on occasion? We're just getting a lot of emails about this.
I really think that we should be thinking not what kind of fish, but when you look at anything, it's not just what we're eating. It's who are you? Where did you come from? What kind of of world have you experienced? These are wild animals that are equivalent, I suppose, to songbirds and the wild ducks and geese. Taking a few for sustenance is one thing, but making a choice to eat wildlife is truly a luxury for most people on the planet. And we are not fully appreciative of the real cost of, say, eating a carnivore such as a tuna or a swordfish or any of the many kinds of creatures that are on the menus around the world. Lions and tigers eat plant-eating animals. Fish, by and large, the big fish that we mostly consume, eat other fish that eat other fish that eat other fish, and pretty soon you get down to the phytoplankton, the zooplankton that eats the phytoplankton. It's a long and twisted food chain with energy consumed along the way. To make a pound of a cow takes about 20 pounds of plants. To make a pound of chicken, it's maybe 2 pounds of plants. To make a pound of tuna or swordfish or halibut, we're talking tens of thousands of pounds of phytoplankton plants at the bottom end of the food chain that go through this twisted connection to what goes on your plate. That creatures that are not just a year old or even 2 years old, they're likely to be 10, 20, 30, or like rockfish, maybe 50 or 60 years old. Orange ruffy can live to be more than a century old. Chilean sea bass, similarly, are ancient creatures. So think about what you're eating. Who are you when you think about choosing fish? The best choices, truly, to get back to your question, are likely to be creatures that are the ocean of chicken. That is, they don't mind crowding. They reproduce quickly. They can be raised in closed cycle systems. Tilapia, like number one, probably. It's an African species in freshwater. But they do grow fast. And the ratio of food consumed to fish produced, it's about the same as chicken. And they're not creatures that have to live a long time before they start to reproduce. They're fast growing and fast to maturity. Catfish, another freshwater species, is a similar champion for producing protein-based, you know, animal protein from a plant-based source, and they do it quickly with about the same ratio as for tilapia. Cultivated salmon, I'd say just don't do it. It's just the cost to where they're grown, the amount of wild life that has to go into every pound of salmon. Again, we're talking about a large quantity of other creatures that have to go to feed. A carnivore, salmon are not plant eaters. They eat other fish, or they eat other animals, including the small ones. But think it through. Make your choices based on smart choices. And think about, do you really enjoy the taste of whatever it is? Or is it marketing that you're responding to? Is it something that's prepared in a delicious way? Well, think of something that is delicious that doesn't require killing animals. Or if you have to kill animals to get what you choose to eat, then think about dining on plant-eating animals rather than carnivorous species.
Well, thank you for the calls. You know, I've been wanting to do, maybe we'll do this for the holidays. We'll have on some chefs or doctors even who can talk about vegetarian and vegan eating just to give people some ideas. So thank you so much for the calls and the emails. Let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Peter in Florida. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Great show. Needs to be said. And by the way, I'm I've been a vegan for 30 years.
Wow.
One of the reasons in 1992 was this scenario of what the world is going through, whether it's global warming, all this, talking about pandemics, all this. If I had said it 30 years ago, Peter, you'd think, Peter, there's no way. Did you have a nightmare last night? And it's all coming true, in spite of all my efforts. And by the way, something with me, Sylvia, what you do is great. I heard you interview before. There's a fish in the Central Atlantic. It lives on the bottom. No one ate it before. It doesn't even reproduce till it's like 30 years old. It lives to over 100 years old. It's called the pink something. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't, but
the pink rupee or something.
You mean orange ruffy?
That's it, orange ruffy. Yeah, and if you hear about that fish, it's like a fish, it's like it doesn't reproduce till it's like 25 years old. And I mean, and then now we're catching and eating it. The thing lives to over 100 years old. All of a sudden you get respect for these animals. It's like, what am I eating? Can I eat something else? I mean, the thing, by the way, Turtle Island restoration, I mean, we're learning these things now about, do you know, it's something called a swimway that they used to, even where they say, okay, you can fish here and there, it turns out that there's a lot of sea life that commute from the Galapagos Islands to Ecuador. Mm. And if you don't stop the fishing for the swimway, you're going to kill them off. You know, so even saying, okay, don't fish here, don't fish there, but it's not that simple. It turns out they're moving all over the place.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for your call. Dr. Earl?
At COP26, an announcement was made by Ecuador, Costa Rica, Colombia, and Panama. The four countries came together to safeguard an area that along their collective coastal waters as a safety zone for these migratory species that include tunas and sharks, marine mammals of various sorts. And it's recognition of just what you're saying, that we set boundaries, that the fish don't know where our politics draw lines in the ocean. And that's not true of all species that are highly migratory, but many are. But others are homebodies, that they find a place, or they start out in one place, and that's where they live their entire lives. And that's often true around coral reefs. There's some visitors to coral reefs that are migratory, like turtles and sharks, but they're also resident species, that's their neighborhood. That's where they stay. Yeah. And there's about orange ruffy. Scientists have called them for a very long time slime heads. But marketers who have gotten a hold of this concept of being able to go out for the first time in all of human history, starting in the early 80s, to capture these deep sea fish with technologies that did not exist before then, to find them and to deploy deep nets to scoop them up, as well as whatever else is down there with them, ancient corals, ancient sponges, old creatures that we just think of as bycatch. They're tossed back into the ocean. Part of the cost of fishing is what we kill in the process of what we take to market. What would you eat, a slime head, if it were called?
Well, Dr. Earl, going back to the announcement from Latin American countries, I mean, I love that as part of Mission Blue, you called these marine protected areas hope spots. How will this be enforced? Because this announcement that came out of these countries, for example, Ecuador's environment minister said that in spite of the fact that we're a developing country, we have one of the largest fishing fleets in the Pacific, we've decided to reduce the fishing effort. How will this be enforced?
That's always a question. The answer, I think, is twofold. One, enforcement is now enhanced by satellite observation that we know where the fishing is taking place. You can see it, you can track it, and the fishermen may start out at sea, but we know where they go, and they can be apprehended if they are illegally fishing. But the biggest problem, number one, is not illegal, unregulated, or unreported fishing. Far and away, the biggest problem is legal fishing, fishing that is not only endorsed by law and reinforced that it's okay to fish in 97% of the ocean, but we subsidize that fishing. We are actually, as taxpayers, paying fishermen to go out and kill the ocean on a scale that we know is not sustainable. Look at the numbers. From 1970 to the present time, the populations of tuna have already been somewhat depleted. They've crashed to about 10% overall, 3% in the Pacific of bluefin tuna, and all tunas, because of their heavy exploitation, are down to historic low levels. Look at what appears on your plate or in the restaurants or in supermarkets. The wild animals there are in serious trouble. Depleted overall, sharks down by 90%. Cod, a fraction of what they were, although they did help supply food for countries in the Atlantic over literally centuries, for 500 years. As our technology to find, capture, and market and consume them increased, their numbers seriously declined. So today, the amount of what we think of in climate terms, the amount of living carbon, blue carbon in the ocean, that really is an anchor for maintaining climate integrity, stability, as it's true with trees on the land. Clear-cutting trees has had a terrible cost and an impact on climate. They capture carbon, store carbon, and sequester carbon on the land. The ocean fish do the same thing through the food chain, starting with photosynthesizers, the phytoplankton, the forests, the little miniature forests of green stuff in the ocean that generates oxygen and captures the carbon, generates the food that goes through the zooplankton, small fish, big fish, and our capacity to remove life at all scales out of the ocean in recent decades has undermined and cut great swaths through these processes that hold the planet steady, the carbon cycle, the nitrogen cycle, the generation of oxygen, the capturing of carbon. It's, we didn't know. I mean, I can't really fault people who in ignorance and thinking that this was a good idea really took far too much. And whether it's on the land, clear-cutting forests, now we are trying our best to protect those forests. But if only we had known the real cost of taking these wild animals and plants, we might have reacted more quickly than we have. We're beginning now to understand and take action. We know it. We have to scale up and hurry up.
We're speaking today with Dr. Sylvia Earle, a renowned oceanographer, and we just got word that Sylvia Earle's event this Thursday is no longer open to the public because of COVID restrictions. So sorry about that. We were getting a lot of emails about tickets, but it's no longer open to the public because of COVID restrictions. It will be streamed live, and we do have a link on our website at yourcallradio.org. Let's take a few more questions, and then we'll get Dr. Earle to respond. Let's go to, is it Dinah or Dina in Green Bay?
It's Dina.
Hi,
Thank
Dina.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have been a fan since I saw you with my kids on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and it actually is making me cry. In fact, we all should be crying during this program. And I think there should be a way that we can all take a pledge to stop eating seafood. There must be something that can have some sense of effect if we can all do something like that.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Dina. We have a few more callers who've been waiting patiently, and we will get Dr. Earle to respond, and we'll definitely do more shows about this because it keeps coming up, especially in email. Let's go next to Kent in Golden Gate Park. Hi, Kent.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead. Thanks for holding.
Thank you for taking my call. I just got a couple of is-it-true questions. One is it true that there are 152,000 deep water fishing vessels fishing around the globe? And number two is, isn't it true that we could produce up to 33 million metric tons of seafood by using aquaculture in the Gulf of Mexico? And wouldn't that be in our national security interest?
Important questions. Thank you. Let's take a few more calls and then we'll get a response. Let's go to Tina in Oakland. Hi, Tina.
Hey, Dr. Earle, thank you so much for your work. I have a quick question with regard to owning 4 rescue cats. How much does pet food, like seafood, and particularly cat food, result in overfishing of the oceans? And thank you so much for this important discussion.
Oh, another good one. Thank you so much, Tina. And let's hear from Rich in Belmont. Hi, Rich.
Yes, I've heard from an organization called geoengineeringwatch.org that the amount of hydrocarbons being burned in the atmosphere is generating more carbon dioxide than the plants and trees on the earth can absorb, and as such it's being absorbed by the oceans, which is changing the pH. And in addition to the fish being destroyed, this is another bad thing for the oceans. I was wondering if you care to comment on that.
All right. Thank you for those questions. Dr. Earle, first off, do we know how many deep water fishing vessels are out there? Kent was wondering if it's true that it's 152,000.
I don't know the exact number, but it is a lot. And that's a problem. A big problem is that we treat ocean wildlife as free goods. You don't have to pay for what you take. It's like having a big grocery store with no checkout cost. You just have to catch things and consume them or sell them. Consuming ocean wildlife for sustenance, for need, is one thing. But the large-scale extraction of ocean wildlife for money is a big problem. It's like you take elephants for their ivory. You're not consuming the elephant for need. You're using them for commerce, for money. And cutting trees, not for direct need, but you're selling the trees for cash. It's something we have to rethink, the ethics, the morality of killing wild things and selling them. We get it. Wildlife trade on the land has massive regulation associated with it, but the biggest wildlife trade on earth is what we take from the ocean for trade, not for need, but for choice, a choice to take free goods and sell them. So that's one aspect that needs some attention. There are other questions that were in that mix about aquaculture.
Right.
And can we supply food needs, targeting the Gulf of Mexico? I think some aquaculture not only is inevitable, but it's being done in some ways more efficiently and has been done for probably thousands of years in contained systems. Pond culture in China, not as much today as it once was, where several species are grown together, mostly carp, and ducks on the surface that help fertilize the water. And they also produce eggs and meat. And all around, the fertilizer that is generated is fostering mulberry trees for silkworms and gardens for other crops to make more use of smaller places. And in the ocean, growing carnivores and using the ocean as a farm has real consequences. We've seen it with salmon. They're carnivores. It takes a lot of big fish, a little fish, to make the big fish. And it's not a really good business model if you're accounting for the cost of what these fish are that are fed to the farm fish. And it's true, that's where the great majority of the little fish that are taken out of the ocean, and a lot of the big ones too, wind up as food, not for humans, but for cattle, for chickens, for pigs, and of course for our pets, cats and dogs. And sometimes it arrives in a form that you don't realize that it's in dog food, but it's there as fish meal or some a general term that you wouldn't identify quite readily what it is that is in that mix of pet food. So knowing is really the key. Once you get it, once you understand your individual choices about what to eat or what animals are more or less acceptable or not, you realize we don't have to eat any of them. It's a choice, and it's driven by habit, it's driven by custom, and it's certainly driven by marketing. You know, pull back the layers. Ask yourself, what choices do you want to make that will make a difference? And think of that in terms of 1 × 10 × 100, 1,000, 1,000,000. Every choice added up makes a real difference.
Dr. Sylvia Earle is a world-renowned oceanographer who has spent the past 70 years exploring our vast ocean. She has dedicated her life to raising awareness about the importance of protecting our ocean. Her new book is National Geographic Ocean, A Global Odyssey. She'll be speaking this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. in Sausalito. Sorry, I got that wrong earlier. The event is not open to the public because of COVID. We do have a link on our website if you'd like to watch the event. Dr. Earle, thank you so much for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on board.
Thank you. We'd love to have you back. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. You can find more information and be sure to watch that incredible documentary called Mission Blue to learn more about our oceans and about Dr. Earle's really fantastic work. You can find a link at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.